Welcome back to the second installment of the Shades of Magic read-along. Today we are covering parts 5 through 9 of the first book, A Darker Shade of Magic. As you can see, I am feeling very ready. I have so much to talk about. Now, just a quick reminder where we left off. Kel had just made some poor decisions in White London and come into possession of both a letter and a piece of payment. He does not know what this payment is. He probably should have checked. It's going to come back to bite him. But first, we are going to return to Lila Bard. So we catch back up with Lila Bard, who has obviously just pulled another steal. She's got some fresh coins in her pocket. She's heading back to the Stone's Throw, where she now lives, grudgingly. And on her way there, she passes a street urchin, kind of right outside the Stone's Throw, who's clearly in need, and she gives him one of her coins. And Baron catches her, the owner of the Stone's Throw, and makes a comment about her actually having a heart under there, and she does not want that reputation, so she's like, absolutely not. Don't just let it go. But they're about to head inside when she sees three kind of street rats, three teenagers accost that boy, that little street urchin, and steal the money she just gave him. Baron's like, let it go. Lila's like, I think I'm not going to. He's like, there are three of them. There's one of you. She's like, I got this. Lila takes off after the three kids. We call them kids. They definitely are. She's outnumbered and outsized a bit. That's going to be important. Meanwhile, we're going to jump to Kel, who has gotten to the address that was on the envelope of the letter that he was asked to deliver. He gets there, and there's nobody there. And it doesn't seem like anybody lives at that address. And his little spider senses start to tingle and be like, maybe I shouldn't be here. And getting a little suspicious, he opens the letter to see what's inside. It's a blank piece of paper. This is clearly a trap. Sure enough, right around there, an assassin, or a cutthroat, somebody of ill repute, we can tell, comes out of the woodwork and starts following him, and he takes off at a run. We've got a lot of running, there's gonna be a lot of people, and their paths are gonna collide. So, back to Lila. Lila is trailing that group of thugs through the winding streets of London, and she very quickly finds herself a little in over her head. There are three of them, and it turns out they are armed, and Lila is very quick, she's very sharp, but she realizes, much to her chagrin, she's going to have to run. And that is a thing that Lila hates. In fact, I think it's probably going to be one of the only times in the series that she is going to run away from trouble instead of toward it. But she does start running. Okay, so now we have Kel running in Red London, Lila running in Grey London. This is very important. So Kel is running away from these who clearly present themselves to be assassins of some kind. And he starts to wonder what it is exactly that he's carrying that might be making them chase him. So he opens the payment. Remember, he was given a letter and he was given a random object as payment and told not to open it. He opens it and he discovers a black stone. Now this black stone he deduces is a relic from Black London. And what we're gonna learn later, but what he kind of parses for us now is that any relic from Black London, from that that world that fell because of how much magic there was, every relic was supposed to be destroyed. This relic has clearly not been destroyed, and it is also etched with the word Vitari. And Vitari is the Antari word for magic, essentially for like the source of magic or a creator of magic. This is slightly ominous. He's like, don't know what to do about that. And sure enough, the cutthroats quickly catch up with him and order him to... There are seagulls in that chimney. Okay, the cutthroats. So as he realizes that what he's holding is a forbidden object of probably a lot of power, these cutthroats catch up with him and order him to surrender the object. He refuses to surrender. Also, he does note that these cutthroats seem to be compelled in some way. Their voices are very flat, their affects very flat. They don't seem all there, all at home, as they're demanding that he surrender. He fights back and he gets injured in this fight by a weapon that cuts him off from his own magic. Remember, his magic is near limitless, but this is a weapon that essentially temporarily severs the user from magic. He is now outnumbered in a bad way, and he ends up relying on the stone accidentally for help. He kind of thinks like, you know, oh shit. He thinks stop as the attacker comes toward him, and the stone reacts to this call for help. And it actually overtakes the attacker and freezes them. And so Kel does not want to have this stone on him, but in that moment he's quite grateful because it helps him get out of the situation alive. He is, however, injured, We should know that is going to be important. He has been injured in this fight. He is now in possession of the stone. He is running again because he's like, I got to get out of here because there might be more assassins. So he is now in the next chapter bleeding profusely, something he does a lot in this book, sometimes willingly because we need blood for magic and sometimes because he gets stabbed. And this is one of the latter. So he has been stabbed and he needs to go somewhere that these attackers cannot follow him. And so his mind goes to, I need to go to Grey London. I need to go another London over because then at least I can figure out what's happening without being continuously pursued. This is my favorite chapter because this is about to be an iconic moment and it's the very first moment that I ever envisioned for the book. I'll tell you when we get there. So Wounded Kell heads into Grey London and promptly collides with Lila Bard. Lila Bard has been running away from her attackers. Kell is running away from his attackers. They collide with each other literally in an alley. She steadies him, asks if he's okay, and in the process of steadying this bleeding stranger, picks his pocket, as she is wont to do. She is always picking everyone's pocket. Kell does not realize this. He staggers on, and she leaves, and about a block later, he realizes that he's been robbed. Now, that moment where Kell walks through a door in the world and collides with Lila Bard, who at this point is dressed as a boy, that is the very first image I ever had for the books. Like, I usually get a still frame in my mind, and then I build a story around that still frame. The still frame I had was in red, black, and white in my mind, and it was this bleeding man in a fabulous coat, almost stumbling through a wall in the world, and colliding with this girl dressed like a boy who picked his pocket. So it was very exciting in my read-along to get to part 5, chapter 5, because it's kind of the thing that started it all. But we have had this collision, and Lila is now in possession of the Black Stone. Now we have a tiny interlude. I'm very fond of tiny interludes because, again, they show us almost like a crow's eye view of somewhere else in the city. We get to, like, pivot for one moment. And this is going to be important because Kell had those attackers coming after him. He used the Blackstone's magic in order to protect himself from them. And in the process, one of them was killed and one of them was frozen inside of this magic. Now, something has happened because that magic begins to thaw around this attacker. But as it thaws, it seeps into him and it possesses him. And what we're very quickly going to discover is that Vitari, this object of magic, is actually conscious, that it has an identity, that it has a will. And what's happening is that everything it touches, every human, every living thing it touches, it's going to be able to stain. It's going to be able to possess and take control of. And this is the very first time we're seeing it with one of those attackers. And it should give us a very small uh-oh in the back of our mind because we are realizing that magic, in this case, has a point of view. We haven't gotten it yet, but as it takes over these bodies, it tends to kill the host and then possess it. We start to get the sense that it has its own mind and its own perspective. So, tiny little uh-oh. With that, just tuck it away in the back of your mind. We head back to Lila Bard. And Lila Bard is walking away from this stranger that she has just robbed, and she is wondering what she took, because it was basically a blind steal, where she reached in the pocket, she swept something, but she doesn't know what it is. She's hoping it's valuable. So she's pretty disheartened when she realizes it's a rock. It's just it's not even like a nice rock. It's like a piece of broken black rock. She's pretty disappointed. She thought it would be like silver or a gem of some kind. She's still trying to figure out what she's going to do about that because now she doesn't even have any more money. She feels like she's trapped in this cycle where she's just stealing enough to eat for that day. She's never going to get out of this life. She's pondering what to do with this stupid rock when she gets to her room in the stone's throw and Kell is there, bleeding, half conscious, no clue of how he got in, and demanding that she gives this stone back to him, which of course she says no to because she's Lila. And he basically comes toward her as if to take the stone back and collapses because, as we said, he's been bleeding for a little while now and he's been injured and he's not doing too well. And he wakes up just long enough for Lila to see the color of his eyes. One is blue and one is solid black. She's not sure what to make of that. And so she hits him with a book and he passes out and is unconscious. She feels pretty good about that choice. Now, this is what part? This is part 6, chapter 3. Is probably my favorite chapter in the book. I'm not gonna lie, this is one of my favorite chapters. It makes me smile every time I think about it. I have worked on it in every adaptation because I just am like determined for it to exist in every form that it does. This is the scene where Kel wakes up tied to Lila's bed. It's a very important moment for all of us. I think we should just embrace that fact. He wakes up tied to her bed, and this is one of those chapters actually that has to do a lot of work creatively, because this is not only going to be Lila's real introduction to Kel, it's Lila's introduction to magic and to this world. He wakes tied to her bed, and we have all of my favorite things in this chapter. We have a lot of banter, a lot of very quick back and forth banter between the two of them. We have danger and knowledge and magic, and really getting the sense of their fates becoming deeply entangled in this scene. Because Kel's essentially like, untie me, and Lila's like, don't think so. And he's like, where's that stone? And she's like, yeah, I'm not gonna give it to you. And then he tries to take it back, and he's tied to her bed. So there's really not a whole lot. And I think this is that moment where we're starting to understand how they're gonna behave together as a pair. Like, long before they're a couple, just as a pair, they're just sniping at each other. They're just very, very quick back and forth. Kel is continuously exasperated by Lila. Lila doesn't really give a shit about that. And finally, she's like, I'm not gonna let you go till you tell me how you got in my room without using a door or a window. And he's like, I use magic. And she's like, okay, yeah, sure. And he's like, no, I use magic. And she's like, great, show me. And so he gives her a demonstration of magic. And I think he thinks she's going to be like, oh my God. She's just like, cool, I want that. And basically she's like, so what's the rock do? And he tells her, Kel really shouldn't just be telling Lila things, but he tells her it makes magic. So of course Lila would really like a demonstration of that. And Lila gives herself a demonstration. At this point, Kel has freed himself from the bed using magic. That was part of his demonstration, but Lila still has the stone. And she then conjures for herself a sword. Because she's like, oh, I can do anything. I'm going to do the something then. And she conjures for herself a sword. And he's like, great. You can see. It does magic. Give me the stone right now. It's super dangerous. Sorry, I hiccuped. But it sounded like a burp. That was weird. okay. So she conjures a sword for herself. This is like gorgeous, gleaming black sword. Because kind of everything that the magic makes is a little bit stained by the stone itself. Anyway, and he's like, great, you can see it does magic. Magic is real. Yay, give me the stone. It's really super dangerous. And she's like, I am not done yet. And this is my favorite moment. I don't care. I picture all of my scenes as like film scenes. And this one lives in my head rent-free because this is the moment that Lila then decides to use the stone to create a shadow version of Kel. Just to do a striptease for her. She's like, this might be fun. She conjures a version of Kel out of the stone. And Kel is like, this is not funny anymore. And she's like, I am having a great time. I don't know about you. And the problem is that, as we've discovered, but Lila and Kel haven't discovered yet, this stone has an identity. And so by creating a living person, a vessel for this stone to inhabit, it very quickly takes on a life of its own. And it very quickly tries to attack Lila in a way that that inanimate object did not. And Kel's like, yeah, you got to dispel this magic now. And she's like, I know how to do that. I literally just learned that magic was real. Anyway, Kel finally is able to dispel the shadow Kel. And he then promptly pins Lila to the wall, which is kind of hot. But like the point of him pinning her to the wall is that he then takes the stone off her. And she's like, great, let me go. And he's like, no. And he then uses the wall to hold Lila. He essentially has the wood of the wall bind Lila in place. And she's like, yeah, how am I supposed to get out of that? And he's like, you have knives. You know, take your time. And Kel leaves. So we have Kel has left the building with the stone. Lila is stuck to a wall at home. And yeah, that is probably one of my favorite scenes that I've ever written. It took weeks because it's trying to do a lot of things. It takes Lila, we're in chapter 4 now, takes Lila a very long time to hack and slash her way free from a wooden wall. But she does, and she's pretty pissed off about it. And something else has happened that I think is really important to cover because I haven't covered it yet. And that's that every time one of them uses the black stone, to create magic, they feel a little more seduced by that magic. So Lila felt an innate draw to power when she was creating. Kel is very aware of it too. It's one of the reasons he doesn't want anything to do with the stone. Lila's a bit more intoxicated by it. Think of that like one ring with Frodo. Think of that one ring with Frodo in like the first Lord of the Rings movie where it's very intoxicating. Anyway, so Lila picks up the sword that she made, which she still has, is very tempted by it, can still feel that power ringing through it, but Lila knows better. Lila's a lot smarter than that, and Lila chucks that sword out the window. And it's in a scabbard, so it's like not likely to hit anyone on the way down, but it's important that she chucks it out the window. She's like, that's bad magic. I don't like that. And at the end of this scene, she basically is like, I gotta go get a drink. This has been a bad fucking day. Like, I don't know where Kel is. He's gone. I want magic. It's gone. And now I'm alone again with no money. And my wall's all fucked up from, like, having to hack at it. And I need a drink. So she leaves. But at the end of this scene, we get a man stumbling out of the stone's throw, very drunk, who picks up that sword. And much like everything else we've seen that the Black Stone's magic touches, it quickly overtakes him as well. So we get this little sense that we're spreading. Things are spreading. It's a bad stain, and it's also got a mind of its own. I have a note to myself for part 7 that I don't know where this part title came from. It's called The Follower. I have no memory of naming this part that. I think this is what happens when you're like 600,000 words in to the amount of words you've written for a series. I don't remember that at all. But I do remember this chapter. Okay, so this is chapter 1, and I wrote a note to myself that I really love, probably like my personal favorite thing to do, is showing off different character dynamics in relation to each other. So we've just gotten that Kel-Lila dynamic that I love so much. But we're about to get Lila and Holland. Remember, Holland is the other Antari. He's the one from White London. He's the one who's been tortured and bound into service. He is the one who is the antagonist of this book. So Lila is off getting herself a drink. She has no stone. She has nothing to show for herself. She's just trying to get smashed. And someone steps up beside her at the bar. And it's Holland. Holland immediately gives her the creeps. Like, he has bad vibes written all over him. And on top of that, he looks straight at her and she sees that one of his eyes is all black, realizing that this is another Antari magician just like Kel. Except he doesn't feel like Kel. He feels like the opposite of Kel. He feels like the anti-Kel, and it is giving her massive, massive creep. And sure enough, he's like, where is he? And Lila's like, I don't know who you're talking about. And he's like, I need to find Kel. Where is he? And she's like, again, wrong tree that you're barking up. And he's like, I can smell his magic on you. And she's like, that is creepy. But she does say one of my favorite lines, which is perhaps because he used it to cuff me to a wall after I robbed him blind and tied him to a bed. If you're looking for a friend, don't look at me. We met on bad terms and parted on worse. So she's like, yeah, fuck off. But Holland's like, no, you're going to help me find Kel. At which point Holland drags her out of the tavern and into an alley and is like, don't worry, we'll persuade him. And then he proceeds to like torture Lila to try and get Kel's attention. Feels a pretty rude thing to do to someone that you just met. And Lila's also like, yeah, he's not gonna come. Like, I tied him to my bed, I robbed him. He then tied me to a wall and left. We are not friends. And Holland, though, is very convinced he will come. And sure enough, Kel comes. Like, Kel comes to Lila's rescue. We are about to enter this little seesaw of them having to save each other and being really angry about it, which might be one of my favorite tropes. Lila is not happy about the fact that Kel came back, but in like a deeply existential way. Lila's not happy about not understanding why Kel came back, like because she would not have gone back for him. That's really what it is. She's like, why did he come back for me? I would not have come back. And he basically tells her, like, go, get out. And Lila's like, don't tell me twice, bye. So Lila leaves, and Holland and Kel are fighting each other, facing off against each other. Kel goes to save Lila. Kel obviously hears Lila scream or something. And what I really love is there's a line that says, it's her own fault, thought Kel, even as he ran toward the scream. And that really is their relationship in a nutshell, is that they're bitter about having to save each other, but they keep doing it. And then they kind of like go into this cycle of being indebted to the other person. Anyway, he tells Lila to leave, and Lila does. Lila's like, bye guys, I'm out, enjoy your magic fight. So Lila takes off, and Kel is left to face off with Holland. Now, Holland and Kel technically are the same kind of magician. They have the same technical amount of power, but the fact is they don't use it in the same way. Holland is an older magician than Kel, and Kel is really out of his depths. Holland has come from a world where you had to be willing to do anything. And Kel has come from a very privileged and protected world. And sure enough, Kel is out of his depths fighting Holland, and Holland clearly takes control of the situation. Holland gets his hands on the stone, and at that point, the fight is pretty much over. He does something with the stone that causes Kel to begin to, like, bleed from the inside. Like, just a lot of blood. And he can't even say a spell. He can't even use that blood to turn it into magic because blood is literally coming up. Super gross. Love it. And basically, this chapter has a lot of one-liners. Holland's just got some really sick burns in here that I like. But anyway, it's pretty clear that Holland is winning and Kel's super screwed. And then Lila comes back. And Lila hits Holland over the head and helps Kel escape. Lila is, I just want to point out, really angry about having to come back. In fact, the only reason that she comes back for Kel is because Kel came back from her and she can't really handle it. It's pissing her off because she doesn't know why he did it and she needs to understand why. Anyway, the other thing that we learn in this fight with Holland before Lila saves Kel is that Holland has this silver seal on him that we assume is the thing that's binding him into the Dane twin service, that this is the thing. And Kel says to Holland, oh, like, you could use the stone to break the seal, like, to set yourself free from the Dane twins. At which point Holland reveals that the seal, this is just a clasp. It's a symbol. The seal is actually burned into his soul. There is literally no way to get out of this bondage that he is in to the Dane twins. That's going to become important. So that's a sidebar. Anyway, Lila comes in again. Lila saves Kel bitterly. Very not happy about this. Would have loved to just go home and live her life. Knocks Holland unconscious and is like, okay, Kel, we got to get out of here. Lila then drags a half-conscious, again, once again bleeding, Kel back to the stone's throw. And Baron is like, what are you doing? Like, this man is bleeding everywhere. Baron and Kel kind of know each other because Kel constantly, like, brings his smuggling wares to the stone's throw. Baron and Kel have crossed paths in the past, but Baron is like, what are you doing? You are so in over your head. And Lila's like, stop nagging me and help me get this body upstairs. Baron helps. He goes downstairs, at which point Lila kind of sits and watches Kel sleep. But, like, not in a loving way, definitely in a, like, why would you come back for me? I don't understand. It's really pissing me off. But also, Lila says when she's dragging him, or thinks when she's dragging him back to the stone's throw, it says, Kel made a soft sound between a gasp and a groan, and Lila started talking, worried that he might die on her, and it would somehow be her fault, even though she'd come back. And, like, this is the thing. Lila, definitely, her love language is actions, but they're very grudging actions. So with that, Lila drags Kel back into her room and puts him on her bed for the second time that night. And we are now in part 8. So Kel wakes up. He is not tied to her bed this time, so that's really nice for him. And this is the other really important chapter because he's basically going to tell us and Lila everything I've already told you about the four Londons and the four worlds and how they were connected and how they fell apart. So basically he explains that this black stone is a relic from Black London and that all of those relics were ordered to be destroyed. Obviously, this one has not been destroyed. And this brings us to the mission, right? Which is that Kel realizes that if this cannot be destroyed, it needs to be returned to Black London. And what's tricky about this is that Antari magicians carry tokens on their person to move between the worlds. He had a shilling from Grey London. He has a specific article from Red London. He has an article for White London. This would be the article from Black London. Like, so he technically will be able to make that door. But in order to cross from one world to the next, he has to go in order. So the worlds aren't just kind of circling around each other. They are like pages in a book. So it goes Black London, and then White London, and then Red London, and then Grey London. They're in Grey London, and they need to get to Black London. They're going to have to go through Red London and White London first. So it makes it extremely dangerous for many reasons, but also, I said they, but it's clearly not a mission that Kel plans to involve Lila in. Kel's like, give me the stone, I gotta go take it back to Black London. And Lila's like, sounds like fun, where do I sign up? And Kel's like, you physically can't even move between the worlds, I'm pretty sure. Like, only an Antari could actually move between the worlds. And she's like, that's great, though. I have this stone, which it can basically do anything. So I think I can use the stone's power to go from world to world with you. And he's like, why do you have this death wish? And she basically is like, I don't. I have a life wish. She's so stuck in her own life. She wants to have an adventure. And that's essentially like where we get one of the most famous lines in the book, which is that I'd rather die on an adventure than live standing still. And so by the end of this chapter, we have learned that this black stone and all of its magic must be returned to Black London. And we have learned that Lila is coming along for the ride. We now in chapter two, Kel's like very grudging about this and is like, you'll probably be torn apart in the universe by the process. I don't think this is going to work, but if you insist on this, Lila's like, I insist. And Kel leads her outside because the other rule that we learn is that when you move from one world to the other, you move from the exact same place to the exact same place. So he wants to get to a specific place in Red London, and he wants to get as close as possible because obviously they're being hunted by Holland. And so he wants to walk closer to that place in Grey London so that when he makes the door, he'll be right where he needs to be, or at least closer to it in Red London. And he finds the spot, and they have a little bit of like witty banter, and we get probably my favorite lines in the book, which she basically, he's like, I don't know if this is going to work. And she's like, don't worry, I'm not going to die, she said, not till I've seen it. And Kel says, seen what? And she says, everything. So with that, they step through into Red London. Before we follow them there, though, we have to cut back to Baron, the owner of the Stone's Throw, who is now alone, and he hears something upstairs in Lila's room. He goes up to check on her, and he finds Holland. Holland, who has been trying to hunt down Kel and Lila. Holland, who would like to know where Kel and Lila are, and when Baron refuses to tell him, he kills Baron. And we have our first death of the book and our intro into part 9, Festival and Fire. So Kel and Lila step through into Red London, but first we are with Kel, and Kel very quickly realizes that Lila is not with him. Kel steps through the door, is like, great, that worked, turn towards Lila, Lila is gone. We have an oh shit moment because Lila is gone and Lila has the stone, because Lila has refused to hand over the stone because she knows that if she does, Kel will not take her with him. So Kel gets to Red London, is like, great, and then is very quickly like, shit. But before they went through the door together, Lila gave Kel a token of her own. She gave him a kerchief because in her mind she was like, I've taken something from you, you can have something from me, whatever. It's obviously going to be important in finding Lila. He's now going to use that kerchief and some magic to find Lila. But meanwhile, we're going to cut to Lila. Lila ends up in Red London. There's no Kel, but she's not actually concerned about that because she's like, he's found me once, he'll find me again. Meanwhile, Lila is like, holy shit, I am in a world full of magic. This is amazing. Like, we have finally broken through something. And Lila's having a great time. Lila is walking essentially the same path that Kel walked at the very beginning of the book, but now we're seeing it through Lila's eyes. And this is one of my favorite kind of craft details as a writer, which is that you have to remember that when you have a character's perspective, even if it's in third perspective instead of first perspective, you are seeing through their eyes, and different people notice different things. Kel moves through Red London as a native to Red London, as a person who is born and raised there in this climate of magic. He is not going to notice the same things that Lila Bard notices. Lila steps into this world. She's like us. She is from a magic-free world, and she is noticing everything for the first time, and she's like a famished person, just gorging on the idea of this world and all of its magic. She is deeply entertained. She finds herself at the night market, which is a place that Kel found himself in his own adventures in Red London. And because it's a market, she promptly tries to steal something. Like, that's pretty much her MO wherever she goes. The problem is that she gets caught because there are magical wards in place to prevent stealing in this market. And shit's about to go down when Kel arrives and kind of bails her out from the situation. And Lila very quickly notices that Kel is treated kind of differently in this world. Like, she met him as just a rando on the street who had clearly been stabbed. Here, they're like, they're afraid of him, or they're respectful to him. They're treating him in a way that she doesn't really know what to do with, and she makes a mental note of it. And meanwhile, he's like, I can't believe you can't even just, like, stay out of trouble for 5 minutes. We start to get the banter between Kel and Lila that will live forever in their relationship, which is Lila no, Lila yes, which is essentially Kel telling Lila, please don't, and Lila being like, I'm going to do that, though. So we're going to break away for just a moment to another part of Red London. I completely forgot about this chapter until I reread it. It's a chapter about a man named Aldous Fletcher. I even wrote, I forgot about him. And essentially, all we need to know, this is 25-year-old me doing something I'm not sure 35-year-old me would have done. I would have found a way to, like, weave it in a little bit more. But basically, we are going to a pawn shop where we learn that a man named Aldous Fletcher has a white London token. He doesn't know what it is. It's a, I think he thinks he knows what it is, but essentially it is a chess piece from White London. It's going to become important that Aldous Fletcher has a piece of White London in his shop that he keeps on his person. Just put it in the back of your mind for next week, okay? He has an object, they're going to need the object. We'll get to that. We're going to come back to Kel and Lila. Kel is walking with Lila, he's leading her to his bolt hole, to his place where he keeps all of his tokens for gray and red and white London so that he can get what he needs. And this is the part where Lila's like, hey, people seem to be treating you kind of weird. And he's like, I don't know what you're talking about. And she's like, who are you? And he's like, you know who I am. I've already told you who I am. And she's like, no, who are you here? And we're going to get to one of my favorite lectures by Lila Bard in the entire book, because Kel's going to do his little pity me story about how I'm not really a prince. I'm a possession of the royal family. They don't love me, this kind of thing. And Lila is going to lose her goddamn mind about it. And she basically says, you have a house, if not a home. You have people for care. You have people who care for you, if not about you. You may not have everything you want, but I'd wager that you have everything you could ever need, and you have the audacity to claim it is all forfeit because it is not love. Love doesn't keep us from freezing to death or starving or being knifed for the coins in our pocket. Love doesn't buy us anything, so be glad for what you have and who you have, because you may want for things, but you need for nothing. And Kel is chastised. Kel is put in his place about perspective a little bit. At which point they arrive to the place that they're going, Kel's little bolt hole, his little house moving castle-esque nook where he keeps all of his trinkets. And he's hoping to find something to take them to White London. And, oh, the entire building has been burned out, which is not great. So it has been completely destroyed in a way that is very obviously not natural. Very not good considering that his collection has been destroyed with it, including the tokens he would use to get him to White London. Kel is like, shit. Lila's like, tell me you have trinkets elsewhere. And Kel's like, I have one. It's with a guy named Fletcher. See, I told you we were going to come back to it. It's with a guy named Fletcher. We should probably go to that shop. And before they can go, Holland shows up. Holland, who very clearly burned down this building. And Kel, in an instant, grabs Lila and the stone and uses the Blackstone's magic to conceal them from Holland. And Holland can kind of sense them there in the wreckage of this place, but he can't see them. And he starts trying to goad them to come out. And he aims for Lila because he has a feeling he can goad her more. And he almost does because he tells her about killing Baron. And he provides proof. And Lila almost breaks, is tempted, but they do hold out until Holland leaves. At which point Lila gathers herself back together and essentially says which way to Fletcher's shop. And that's where we leave off for this week.